This hour on Behind the Headlines, Utah's attitudes about some, but not all, rights for gays are changing. That's according to a new Salt Lake Tribune opinion poll. So what does this mean for the prospect of civil unions, adoption, and gay marriage here in Utah? Videos of former Attorney General John Swallow's depositions are released, while the public isn't sold on continuing to investigate his alleged misbehavior. How will all of this play into ongoing probes? And the dramatic murder trial against Isar Met takes an equally dramatic turn. How will new evidence affect closing arguments and the outcome of the case? The week's news, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, poll numbers, the Swallow tapes, the Isar Met trial, and more. Joining me to talk about the top news stories of the week, Tribune reporters Marissa Lang, who is a justice reporter. Glad to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Robert Gerke, who covers state government. Robert, great to have you back.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And editorial writer George Pyle. Welcome to you, George.
Thank you. Good morning.
And you can join us as well. How are you thinking about gay rights, including civil unions, adoption, same-sex marriage? Do you think the state should continue to fund investigations into allegations of wrongdoing by former AG John Swallow? Any other news stories on your mind, send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or you can put them in the comments section of our page at sltrib.com. You can also call us live, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We've got a lot to talk about this week. Marissa, I know you need to run to court, so I'm going to start with you. You've been covering the murder trial of Isar Met, the 27-year-old accused of killing a 7-year-old girl who lived in his apartment complex. Maybe you can walk us through the timeline of events. What do we know about this murder?
Sure. So Sarah Namu was a 7-year-old girl who lived in the South Park apartment complex in South Salt Lake. And we know that she disappeared sometime around 1:30 p.m. on March 31st, 2008. Mm. She was last seen visiting a friend's home shortly thereafter and then never again. Isar Met was a neighbor of hers of sorts. He lived a few doors away. And the girl would go over to his home and play with him every so often. And he was not seen that day for much of the day. Later on, he went to an aunt and uncle's home in Cottonwood Heights. Police started searching for the girl that night. They searched well into the night, couldn't find any trace of her, continued the next day around 7 or so that next evening on April 1st, 2008. They found her body in Isar Met's bathroom. He was arrested that night at his aunt and uncle's home, and the case has sort of been ongoing since then.
Hmm. The prosecutors presented some pretty chilling facts in the case, including some very disturbing pictures. It's still early in the morning, so don't go too far.
I won't.
But maybe you can briefly describe some of the harsh evidence that was presented this week.
Sure. So a lot of the evidence focused on what happened to her physically. There was a lot of, like you said, very gruesome evidence presented. The girl did suffer quite a bit before she died, it seems.
The testimony said that the examiner's internal injuries in addition to,
yes,
to broken bones and just awful things.
They believe that what killed her was a tear to her heart, or the lining of her heart, that actually caused some internal bleeding. According to the medical examiner, she didn't suffer probably more than an hour. So that means that all of this happened within that time frame. But they also presented some DNA evidence. They've collected DNA from the defendant's jacket. He owned apparently one denim jacket, and on the back of which had 4 blood spots they identified as belonging to the little girl. And then DNA or skin samples collected from under her fingernails. The prosecution believes that she scratched her attacker, and that DNA matched a profile shared by Isar Met. So they're using that to show, in their opinion, that he must have done this to her. She fought back, scratched him, and preserved that DNA under her fingernails.
You were in the courtroom as this brutal evidence was released. What was the reaction?
It was very silent in there. It was very hard to look at. There were certainly some folks who were blinking back tears. Some people who were looking away had their heads in their hand. Jurors, unfortunately, didn't have that luxury, so they had to view all the evidence, as did I. But there were a lot of people in the room who I think were very disturbed by those images.
And what was the jury reaction? Did you see any visible evidence, expressions, or gestures?
Yeah, I mean, people looked pained and uncomfortable. Mostly the jurors were taking notes. They've been very diligent, it seems, throughout the whole trial. A lot of notebooks and pens coming out in the jury box.
What's the jury profile?
It's 11 people, 5 men and 6 women. And it's a fairly young jury. I remember sitting in on jury questioning and hearing that a lot of them actually had young children at home.
The young girl, excuse me, is it Serenemu?
Serenemu, yes.
Part of a family that had seen extreme hardship even before this, before coming to this country. Describe what we know about their refugee experience.
They're from Burma, which is now Myanmar. They're of the Karen ethnicity. So they actually had to flee the country during the civil wars. They fled to Thailand, spent some time in a refugee camp there. Actually, Serenemu was born in the Thai refugee camp. And then eventually the family got the opportunity to come to the United States. They came here to Salt Lake City, and they were not here terribly long before this happened, not quite a year.
And the defendant, he is not of the same ethnic background.
Correct. He's also Burmese, so they are from the same country, but he is of Muslim origin, and so he's actually from a different ethnicity. He speaks Burmese, whereas the girl's family speaks Karen. They didn't live in the same part of the country. There's a lot of rifts between them ethnically.
Did you get a sense of how the girl and the defendant met? You said that they had an association. She would go to his apartment. How did they get together?
The defendant, apparently, he had played with children in the apartment complex. He would go and, you know, give them piggyback rides in the playground or play tag and cook them snacks, have them over and watch movies. It wasn't just this girl. It was her best friend, a few of the other little children. He taught them to ride bikes. So I think they just met in the community. It seems like the children would just play outside, and it was kind of a very open situation.
Speaking with Justice reporter Marissa Lang from the Salt Lake Tribune here on Behind the Headlines, if you'd like to join us, we're talking about the week's top headlines, and the number is 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255, or you can go online to sltrib.com. And if you haven't seen it, former Tribune reporter Julia Lyon went to Thailand to trace Mu's family story. There's a powerful series of stories on our website at sltrib.com. Did Isar Met, the defendant, did he share a similar refugee experience to Ersenemu's family?
Similar. He also fled to a camp in Thailand. It was not the same camp. I don't believe that her family and his family had any association prior to them coming to this country. But interestingly, he did know the brother of the little girl's best friend. They had all lived in the same refugee camp in Thailand, and they're also Burmese and Muslim, so they had spoken and knew each other. I don't think they were close, but they knew of each other at least.
And the apartment where Serenemu's body was found, he did not live in that apartment alone.
No, he didn't. He shared the apartment with 4 other men. Those 4 men, also Burmese refugees, but of the same ethnic background as the victim's family. So they were Karen. And the defense has actually latched onto that as a possibility of what happened to her. They've implied over the last 8 days of the trial that it was perhaps one of the 4 roommates who had something to do with the little girl's disappearance and death.
And some new evidence revealed this week, a bit of a shocker. What's the latest there?
There apparently was a blood stain on the upstairs level of the home. So the way this home was organized was Isar Met lived alone in the basement, which is why the girl being found in the basement pointed police in his direction. The 4 roommates shared 2 bedrooms on the upper level, which is the second floor. So there's the second floor, the main floor, and then the basement. When the investigation and the crime scene was going on, they found a stain apparently on the second floor near the bathroom, near to where the roommates were living, and a lab tech on scene did a presumptive test to determine whether or not it was blood, and they found that it was likely blood, but they did not notify anyone that this was blood. They didn't include it in the report given to police or ultimately to prosecutors. And that evidence was actually not revealed to prosecutors or to the defense until this week, actually a couple days ago.
Can you say why? What's the explanation?
The specialist who made this call said that he felt the main crime scene was in the basement, which was pretty bloody, pretty evident that that's where a struggle would have taken place. But he kind of narrowed his focus to the point that he just dismissed this stain upstairs as not being relevant or related. And the defense was very upset by this, obviously, because they felt that in its own way, if it was tested for DNA, if they could prove that it belonged to the child, might actually exonerate their client.
So is that possible? Is that something that the prosecutors and the defense are scrambling over?
Unfortunately, no. The DNA specialist didn't take a swab of that sample. So what that means is they didn't preserve it, and they actually will not be able to test it for DNA. So we know that it's likely blood, but we don't know whose, and we don't know from where, and we don't know from when.
Interesting.
Yes.
What does the judge make of this? Has she made any statements?
She hasn't, but the defense did make a motion for a mistrial on the basis that there's a rule, basically, that says that the prosecution has to tell them of any evidence that might help their case or their client, and they didn't know about this. But they had to withdraw that motion because they couldn't prove that the prosecutors did it on purpose. The prosecution was just as in the dark about it as they were, and they did tell them as soon as they found out.
So the grounds for a mistrial dismissed?
Yes, pretty much. They withdrew it, so they're not seeking a mistrial anymore. But I think it'll make for an interesting caveat going forward.
Yeah. Well, closing arguments set to begin, I guess, in a few moments. What are you
expecting? Very soon.
We're going to get you out of here. What are you expecting today?
Basically, each side is going to have their chance to wrap up what they think happened. The prosecution is going to walk the jury through what happened in the time since Serenamu disappeared. They're going to tell them that she ran into Isar Met, that he took her into his apartment and brutally killed her. And they're going to probably emphasize, I would imagine, the DNA evidence that closely links the two. It shows physical contact, if nothing else, and her blood was found on his jacket. And then the defense is going to have their opportunity to respond. And thus far in the trial, they have maintained that their client did not do this, that it was someone else, and that those pieces of DNA are circumstantial. They've claimed that the girl was being given a piggyback ride, maybe got a bloody nose, maybe had a cut, and bled on the back of his jacket. They're going to say that blood was not found anywhere else. No one can place him at the crime scene, and the DNA found under her fingernails equally circumstantial because she could have scratched them when they were playing tag. Little kids don't wash their hands very well, so on and so forth. So that's what I think we're going to hear today, and then it goes to the jury.
What does this case mean to the local refugee community? Have you had a chance to talk to some of the people who are living nearby or part of the refugee community here?
I haven't, unfortunately. And her family, who have been going through this for the last 6 years, actually haven't attended many of the days of the trial. I think it's very difficult for them to relive the experience of losing their daughter again. And to see those photos and to hear all that testimony, I'm sure was hard or during pretrial proceedings. And I don't think they wanted to subject themselves to it again. But I was told they will be here today and they're going to probably stick around to hear a verdict.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Marissa Lang. Marissa, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Sticking with us, Robert Gerke and George Pyle. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, along with editorial writer George Pyle. And joining us on the phone now is Brooke Adams, who is down south investigating a quadruple murder this morning. But we're going to talk about some other subjects. And Brooke, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Thanks for being here. If you've got something to say about repealing Amendment 3 or the swallow tapes or anything else on your mind, you can send your tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Brooke, it's been a decade since Utahns passed Amendment 3, which defines marriage as between one man and one woman. But a new Salt Lake Tribune poll this week shows that attitudes towards same-sex couples are shifting. And you wrote all about it. The big change, I guess, is that 72% now believe that gay couples should be allowed to enjoy various legal protections. Is that right?
Right. Yes, that's right. So our poll, we asked about 9 questions related to the recent decision by U.S. District Court Judge Robert Shelby that overturned Amendment 3 that banned same-sex marriages here in the state. And on the question of whether same-sex couples should be allowed to get marriage licenses, Utahns were evenly divided, 48-48. And that's actually, I want to mention, kind of in line with a recent Pew poll that found across the country 51% of Americans now support same-sex marriage. So, you know, that gives some confidence about our findings. But the big surprise, as you mentioned, was with civil unions. 72% of Utahns now support civil unions or domestic partnerships for same-sex couples.
Mm. And 65% of those respondents who supported civil unions said that they were Mormon.
That's right.
You interviewed one of them, Mike from American Fork, one of those who was surveyed. How did he explain his feelings on the civil union issue?
He was quite interesting. He's an active Mormon. He's 69, and he said that over time, and he recalled that he did participate in the 2004 election and that he probably had voted for Amendment 3. But he said that his views had shifted over time because of people he knew who were gay. He had a friend, a longtime friend from high school, and who had been married, had a family, but then the marriage fell apart and he came out as gay. So he'd spent a lot of time talking to this friend and had come to believe that this was not a choice. This was innate biology at work. And because of that, people weren't choosing this and should be given civil rights, you know, the civil unions at least. Mike was not for marriage rights. He felt like that was something that should be restricted only to heterosexual couples, but he felt that people like his friend should be able to have civil unions.
It's interesting. I mean, whether or not gay marriage should be allowed, Utahns aren't so sure. They're much like Mike. 65% who were polled still oppose the gay marriage. And can you go a little bit more into that aspect of it from others that you interviewed for the story? What is it about marriage that sets it apart?
Well, some of the people that I talked to, you know, I think are operating from, as we know, Utah's a majority Mormon population. And so some people are looking at it from that perspective, that it should, you know, in their mind, it's a religiously based institution, God developed, that should only be between a man and a woman. And so they feel like opening marriage to same-sex couples is going too far, but they're quite comfortable with civil unions and recognize that many of them have long-standing relationships that should have some protections and legal rights for, you know, to go along with that. And it was interesting because the people that I spoke to, I was really curious about people whose views had changed over time. So I sought those out, and one person I spoke to said their view had become more negative over time, but our poll found that over time most people's views who had a change in point of view had become more accepting. And the people I spoke with said that was because they knew a family member, a friend, business associate or someone personally and had been able to get to know them and talk to them about, you know, these issues. And so they had become more accepting.
There's a comment on our website from Tripster199. Utahns are starting to think like the rest of America instead of acting like they live on an island. George Pyle, I guess there's a transformation that's going on here.
Well, I think that might even be a little bit of an unfair comment. The whole country has moved very rapidly on this. I mean, if you compare the gay rights movement to the civil rights movement, which arguably goes back to the Mayflower, and then you go through the Civil War and a century of Jim Crow after the end of slavery, and how long that took and is still taking, the change of views on gay rights, gay marriage, same-sex marriage, civil union, whatever, has been very rapid. And I think it's largely due to what Harvey Milk said to the gay community, which is they need to come out. And just as Brooke said, once people actually know gay people, actually know gay couples, actually know committed gay couples, and realize that they're pretty much like everybody else and they're not a threat to a heterosexual marriage or a heterosexual family, then all of a sudden they actually stop and think about it because it's personal instead of just being this theoretical group of Martians or something that threaten people's lives when turns out they don't.
What do you think about the distinction between civil unions, which more Utahns support, and reserving that institution of marriage for the one woman couple?
Could I hop in
on
that?
Yeah, sure, Brooke.
You know, so previously the gay community has been quite supportive of civil unions and domestic partnerships. I was on, as the Williams Institute at UCLA School of Law will tell you, people have shifted away across the country from being supportive of civil unions, although we're going in the other direction here in Utah, because, you know, I guess the feeling is if civil unions, then why not marriage? You know, go to full bore here. So, so I think that's a little bit interesting that elsewhere there's a trend away in support and for civil unions, but we're moving toward that.
I guess
kind of relationship. Mm-hmm.
That could be a place where you could say that perhaps Utah or other conservative red states maybe are a little different. In much of the country, the civil union was offered as a compromise. You know, way back 5 years ago. That's how fast this has changed. And nationally, that ship has kind of sailed, even though, you know, in European countries, they do bifurcate religious marriage and civil marriage. I mean, you go to the church to get married, and then in France and England, then you go to the registry office and do the marriage ceremony that the state recognizes. Those are two separate things. So the idea that marriage belongs to the church and unions, civil unions, belong to the state is an idea that's pretty well accepted around the world for all couples.
Hmm. Well, and in fact, here in Utah, one of the respondents that I spoke to said, well, if the Judge Shelby's ruling prevails at the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals and then is upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, the solution is to do away with marriage altogether, which do away with state-sanctioned marriage, and just have civil unions for everybody, and then marriage could become a private, religiously-based ceremony.
Now, that's been the argument, you know, privatize marriage. Anything that is described as an institution created of God, the state shouldn't be fooling around in it anyway.
And I've heard that same point made by several conservative legislators. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're making it publicly, but they're certainly quietly saying that they would be amenable to that sort of idea.
No. I mean, it's not as bad as when they integrated the schools and Virginia closed the public schools rather than integrate them. I mean, that was just nasty. But it could be a compromise that could work out in more conservative states where they say, we're just out of the marriage business.
Do you think that this is going to resurrect a revote on Amendment 3, Robert Gerke?
No, I don't think so, because, I mean, they have to reassess how they've drafted the language, I think, at this point, and they're going to wait until the Supreme Court weighs in on it. You know, I think it, after the Supreme Court weighs in on it, they may sort of readdress and see what they can do, you know, and there's some discussion of it about protecting churches from having to marry people. I don't think that's been a problem anywhere, but there is some concern about it. So I think they'll sort of take those intermittent steps or incremental steps. But Amendment 3, I think, is what it is right now, and they're going to let the courts hash that one out.
Brooke, is that what you're hearing as well?
Yes, that's what I'm hearing. I don't think there's any, you know, the conservative parties in Utah would not want to have a revote at this point, I guess, given our poll results, right? And be a dicey proposition. And I have heard some people suggest that maybe we should have a vote on civil unions in the state, but I don't see any movement in that yet. So,
speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams and Robert Gerke, also with us editorial writer George Pyle, and we invite you to join us as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. This from Kathy Larson on Twitter. Will you know when closing arguments begin? This is in the Esar Met case that we were speaking about earlier. And Kathy, any minute now, just to answer that question. Again, if you want to join us, 801-355-TALK. Back to the poll results, Brooke. We asked about legal protections, such as hospitalization and sort of those benefits. Also asked about adoption rights and whether or not unmarried couples, that includes same-sex couples, should they be allowed to be foster parents or to adopt? And it was split. 50% opposed that.
Right. I think it was more split as far as whether married same-sex couples should be allowed to adopt. The vote, let's see, it was 45-45 on that question, so split vote there. The public was quite decisive about whether unmarried same-sex couples in Utah should be allowed to adopt children. Only 26% were in favor of that. 64% said no. And frankly, it's sort of a moot issue here in Utah at the moment because the state law does not allow cohabitating couples, whether they're heterosexual or same-sex couples, to adopt children.
Is that the next battlefront, George Pyle?
Well, it's all going to be in the same mix. I mean, if the Supreme Court comes down and says you have to allow gay marriage, then that battle is over. All adoption goes with marriage. Gay people get married. Gay people can adopt. And I think the state might have grounds to say that couples that aren't married, gay or straight, haven't founded enough of a solid home in order to adopt children. I think, and that way they're not discriminating gay versus straight. So I don't think that would be a legal problem.
Let me illustrate sort of the situation in which this happens. At the rally a week ago at the Capitol, I spoke to a lesbian couple, and one of them had adopted two children as a single parent. But the other partner now wanted to become legally responsible for those children as well. So that's the kind of situation in which this may occur. And also, you know, we saw a number of couples who had children together and wanted to have both parents legally responsible for them. So that's the couples. But I think that's a long fight. Well, at this point.
Yeah, but both the local ruling and previous Supreme Court rulings have, when striking down the Defense of Marriage Act and so forth, have been saying that the argument that allowing gay couples to get married is bad for families is so absurd on its face, because what these people are trying to do is form families. What these people are trying to do is add security to the lives of adopted children. I mean, if you have a same-sex couple that have formed a household, only one of them is the legal parent. Allowing the other parent, de facto parent, to become a legal parent strengthens the family, adds protection to that child's right. And the courts at various levels have said arguing the contrary just doesn't stand up.
We've been talking about the gay marriage issue and some poll results from the Salt Lake Tribune. Ultimately, this issue will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems to be headed that way after the Tenth Circuit considers it. Attorney General Sean Reyes announced this week that he's hired some outside counsel to help with the state's side of the lawsuit upholding Amendment 3. Brooke, who is Jean? Is it Shar? Cher?
I think you pronounce that Cher. And he has some Utah roots. He had an undergraduate degree from BYU. He has a law degree from Yale. He had been working back at a Washington, D.C. law firm, and he has high-level experience arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court as well as in the federal courts. And, you know, interestingly, there's a connection here. I don't know if his name was Venet or it wasn't totally explained to me, but the Sutherland Institute is a big fan of Gene Scherer's and perhaps brought his name forward to the Attorney General. I spoke with Paul Merrow yesterday, who's the president of the Sutherland Institute, and he said, this is the right guy, this is our guy. We're very happy that he signed on to help the state with this battle. And in fact, the Sutherland Institute, so Gene Scherer is going to receive $200,000 for his work defending the state's constitutional amendment at the 10th Circuit Court. If it goes beyond that, then the state will have to ante up some more money. But in the meantime, he's been hired as a fellow at the Sutherland Institute, and they will also pay him to write policy papers that will help attorneys in other states and lawmakers and inform the general public about the conservative point of view on traditional marriage and the natural family.
This question on Twitter from Kyle, is the Sutherland Institute really going to pay the bill for AG's outside counsel? And why is a think tank allowed to do that? He continues, it seems fishy and unfair for an outside private organization to pay for government legal expenses. Brooke, did you get an answer to that?
Well, again, the state is paying him for his work. This is sort of moonlighting for the Sutherland Institute on the side, you might say. Most all of Gene Scherer's time at this point will be directed at defending the state's Amendment 3. He has a very short deadline in which to get papers to the 10th Circuit Court. The state's briefs are due January 27th, so that's very quickly here. When there are lulls and when this is over, I guess he'll be working for the Sutherland Institute and they will be, you know, paying him for his work on their behalf.
$200,000 seems like a cut rate compared to the legal bills that we've seen in the House investigation. Robert, what's going on?
Well, it is a lot less than they had originally anticipated. In response to Kyle's question, I think there is some precedent for groups ponying up some money to pay some legal fees. And in fact, I believe it was Amendment 3, they set up an account, a trust account, so people could contribute to sort of defray the cost of defending this. And it was sort of a failure. I think they only got something like $13,000 or something like that. But it's not unprecedented, and there have been cases that have been taken on contingency, things like drug lawsuits and the big tobacco settlement was taken on a contingency basis, I believe. It's gonna end up costing less than originally anticipated. $200,000. It's a bargain, I guess. If you're originally anticipating $2 million.
Yeah.
There is one more expense with this too. The state has also hired two other attorneys, Monty Stewart and David. I think the last name's Barsh. I can't remember his name right now, but last name. But two other attorneys, and each of them will be paid $50,000. So the total bill at the circuit court level is $300,000. And then, you know, going forward to the Supreme Court would be another cost.
Speaking of money, I want to move on to another issue that came up this week in our Salt Lake Tribune poll that said that Utahns are kind of sick of paying for the investigations into John Swallow's alleged misbehavior. Robert, how was the survey question phrased, and how do the numbers sort of shake out?
Well, the question was, you know, was it worth it for the state to conduct its investigation into Attorney General Swallow or to spend the $3 million to investigate John Swallow? And surprisingly, a little bit, I think there was a plurality of voters or a plurality of those surveyed thought it wasn't worthwhile, I believe. I think it was 48% who said it wasn't worthwhile. And it's kind of hard to put your finger on exactly why that is. I think there's probably a variety of reasons. One of the people I talked to just felt like it was something else that taxpayers were getting hit with, you know, and they didn't feel like taxpayers should be the ones who have to do this. Now, I would point out, I guess, that taxpayers are also paying for the lieutenant governor's investigation. Also paid for that. They're also paying for these criminal attorneys to investigate the attorney general as well. So there's a number of investigations out there that taxpayers are picking up the bill for on this. the other question that we asked was, you know, should the investigation continue after the House investigators made their presentation back in the end of December? They had 2 days where they laid out their findings up to that point. There was some discussion among the members that they should let them finish their work,
sure.
Right? Because they cut it short after the Attorney General resigned. And it looked like there was a possibility that might happen, but they've kind of abandoned that now in the public overwhelmingly by, I believe it was almost a 3-to-1 margin, felt like they didn't want to pay any more money for any more investigation. If there was going to be an investigation, that it could be done by those county attorneys who are doing the criminal matter, handling the criminal matter now.
Uh-huh. George, are we cheap? What's going on?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like you're still making payments on a car that doesn't run anymore. The Attorney General has resigned. There won't be an impeachment. That's what the House was looking into, one of the things it was looking into, and that's the legislative prerogative in this thing is, does this public official deserve to be impeached? Well, that's moot because he's resigned. The other thing, though, that legislative bodies are supposed to look into is when something like this happens that we all agree is bad, and it was so bad that it led to the resignation of a statewide official, what are the laws? What are the laws that were violated? What are the things that we don't like that maybe technically weren't crimes? Should they be? Should we have different laws? Should we have different ways of investigating these crimes? Should we have campaign finance limits, which we don't have now? Should we have better reporting requirements? We do have a lot of reporting requirements. Were they evaded? If they were evaded, could we write a law that would make them more difficult to evade in the future? I mean, there's a point to which you can make something very illegal and you can't make it more illegal. It's still a crime. So maybe there aren't laws to be passed. But the legislature should have a look into this and say, is there anything we can do to keep this from happening again?
Is that what you're hearing from legislators? Are they sort of contemplating lessons learned?
Right. Well, last week, the House committee met again, and they heard proposals from the lieutenant governor's office. The lieutenant governor, you have to remember, hired its own special counsel to conduct an investigation to whether there were election law violations committed. It came back and said there were 5 separate violations. They also, at the end of the meeting this week, laid out a number of recommendations on how to try to prevent something like this from happening again. And a lot of it was focused on sort of clarifying some of the terminology that's used in these disclosures, expanding perhaps the scope, or at least making it clear that, you know, if you're reporting it on your income taxes, it's income and you need to report it on your disclosures. A lot of them were pretty technical. So they did that. And yes, I think there's going to be a larger sort of look at changes to the law that would, you know, sort of refine Utah's ethics policies and you know, conflict of interest policies and so forth. I would anticipate that you'll see that.
Have any bills been filed yet? Any sort of heads up on that?
Yeah, there's a few out there. Patrice Arendt, they mentioned the other day, is working on one that would require political consultants to more clearly itemize the amount the work that they're doing. Because right now, if I'm running a campaign, I raise $1 million, I can pay my political consultant $500,000 for consulting. He can go out and spend that however we want and not have to disclose it. And it creates this opacity that you can't really, we really don't know what the campaign's spending its money on. It sort of defeats the whole purpose of having financial disclosures. And so that's one of the things they're looking at. That was one of the recommendations that the Lieutenant Governor's Special Counsel made as well. There are bills that have been filed to create some campaign limits. Those bills have come up every year for the last several years and never really gotten very far. I don't know what their fate's going to be this year. The Swallow scandal seems to there's a lot of sort of money for favors kind of allegations and things in it. It seems to have less to do with sort of the $50,000 contribution or so forth. So I don't know if the Swallow scandal is necessarily going to be impetus to pass that. And there'll be some others. One of them we polled was changing the way the Attorney General is selected, whether they should have the Attorney General elected as it is now or whether it should be appointed by the governor with the confirmation by the Senate. And the public seems to be pretty overwhelmingly opposed to that as well. I think they like having the option of, or the opportunity to choose the person who's going to hold that office.
George, you're nodding. They got it right?
Well, I think, I mean, there's no system that can't be corrupt. The way we have it now is the attorney general is elected. That means the attorney general or anybody who wants to be attorney general is forced to go out there with his hand out and raise money. And sometimes the best way to raise money is from a few rich people who may have some interest in the attorney general being their friend in the future, which is what seems to have happened here. If the governor appoints the attorney general is out of that loop, except then he's a political appointee of the governor who has to go out and raise campaign money. And what if the next time around it's the governor who is accused of doing bad things? Who gets to investigate him? The attorney general, who was his appointee. Well, you know, so have you solved the problem of corruption there? Now, part of the proposal, as I've read some of these proposals, is that, yes, it would be an appointee by the governor, but it wouldn't be a setup so that it was just a pal of the governor. The candidates would be recommended by a panel. The attorney general would have a single 6-year term, which would overlap governors, not be subject to reappointment, so he wouldn't be running for reelection from day one. That would be a way that you could go a long way to insulate an attorney general, both from the fundraising process and from just being a creature of the governor who would be afraid to investigate the governor.
Yeah,
they also, one of the other provisions of that is that the governor wouldn't be able to fire the attorney general without the consent of the legislature. So, you know, the idea is to create some more insulation for this attorney general so that he doesn't end up with pressure from the governor. Because the argument, as George pointed out, is that, well, yeah, you're taking the pressure off of the attorney general from his donors, but you're adding you're just changing the direction the pressure is coming from, and now it's going to be coming from the governor's office, who has pressures from his donors in the event that there's something that arises in the attorney general's office that needs investigating.
Yeah, what's been real interesting to me about all of this is that it seems to have forced legislators to sort of admit that the process of raising money for a campaign is suspect. It can poison the political system. All these years you've heard legislators say, well, my vote can't be bought for a campaign contribution. My vote can't be bought for a free jazz game. My vote can't be bought for a free round of golf. And nobody's saying that it is, but you gain access, you get to be friends with people, you get to talk to people that you wouldn't otherwise get to talk to. The attorney general's case is perhaps an extreme example of that, but it comes down to the fact that money and politics can be very corrupting.
Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer George Pyle, also with the state government reporter Robert Gerke, and justice reporter Brooke Adams. She's joining us by phone from Linden, where she's covering this morning's tragic story of a quadruple murder-suicide. Brooke, we probably need to let you go, get back at it, but thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jennifer.
And you're listening to Behind the Headlines. We need to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me in studio, Tribune reporter Robert Gerke and editorial writer George Pyle. And we've only got a couple of minutes left, Robert, but I want to touch on some evidence that was released this week, some tapes of former Attorney General John Swallow being deposed. Describe the line of questionings briefly. I mean, what were the investigators sort of honing in on?
Right. Well, these tapes came from the investigation that was conducted by the Lieutenant Governor's office, and they had 2 days of depositions under oath, and it was about 9 hours of testimony all told. So they covered a lot of ground, but it was mainly focused on his relationship with Jeremy Johnson and the money he had received from Richard Rall, who was the Czech City founder, and Jeremy Johnson, and his reasoning for not disclosing some of that money on his financial reports. The tape was actually, the interviews were conducted in October. The tape was actually released last month, but it took us some time to go through the 9 hours and pull out the excerpts that we did. We did about a dozen of them, I believe.
And you can find it at sltrib.com.
And you know, it's interesting because he talks about his state of mind after the notorious Krispy Kreme meeting, how he thought Jeremy Johnson was a monster who might do anything, and he was scared. And his reasoning for not disclosing some of the payments, he said, was because he wanted to send a message to the public that he was done sort of working on doing the side work that he had been doing for a long time before. Although in not disclosing it, he sort of concealed that he had been doing this work for a period of time. The logic in that was a little bit odd, as pointed out by the lieutenant governor's investigation.
It's interesting. I mean, at one point he says, this is, speaking of the Krispy Kreme meeting, mm-hmm. this is my advice to a friend.
Yeah.
He wasn't giving sort of legal advice. It was just one guy to another, compassionate service.
Yeah, and that's, and he also made the statement that that's why he didn't want to get paid for arranging this deal between Jeremy Johnson and Richard Rall to hire these lobbyists to help Jeremy get out of this federal investigation that he was facing. You know, that was interesting. You know, he also he remained involved in Jeremy's case for quite some time after that, too, for a couple of years after that, right up until June of 2012. He was sending emails back and forth to Richard and Jeremy, giving them advice on how to respond to the Federal Trade Commission's investigation into Jeremy's business, right up until almost the time where he was charged. And you know, so at any rate, yeah, he does sort of dismiss the suggestion that he might have gained financially from this, and couched it as him just brokering a deal between a couple buddies.
Hmm. George, just very quickly, thoughts on the Swallow tapes?
Well, they're not as interesting as Bill Clinton's definition with the deposition with the Diet Coke, but they're almost as sickening. From the beginning of this, from our first editorial on this, his defense makes pretty good charges. I mean, his explanation as to why he did the things he's done, he basically admitted, I falsified my campaign disclosures because I knew if I told the truth, it would look bad. And well, and we've known that from the beginning, but the circles that he moves in, the way he thinks, just is chilling. And you ought to take a look at it. I looked at a few of them just this morning. I could only stand so much before I had to give up. It's just disgusting.
It's at sltrib.com. We've got about a minute left, so give me your top story for the underplayed story of the week, George.
Well, a couple of things that might have come to an end. The Senate report on Benghazi pretty much, I think, puts a lid on that scandal. And this, the Congress actually approved a budget.
Oh, that's news. Okay, Robert?
Well, I don't know if this one's underplayed because it actually made some national headlines. But again, Matt Piper's story about the University of Utah tech who switched his semen and impregnated a Texas couple, and the investigation into that's a phenomenal story and a little bit mind-blowing. So to take a look at that one.
My pick is going to come out of the Salt Lake City School Board. Allegations of racism and bias against the city's West Side schools. I think we're going to hear a lot more about Michael Clara's claims of racism and a story that's just not going to die. George Pyle, Robert Gerke, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. In 2009, Kirby and a friend made a pact to hike down the Grand Canyon.
So I started this training program, and I wrote about it quite a bit for weeks leading up to it, that this is what I was doing. This, you know, this is what a pact, you know, you need, and this is how far you need to be able to walk and that sort of thing.
And then the day arrived. You got to the Grand Canyon.
I picked Buck up at the airport, and we drove down to the Grand Canyon. And it's okay when you don't have the Grand Canyon staring you right in the face. And we drove up, walked over to the edge, and I realized, oh, man, this is a bad idea.
And you're supposed to pack light. And I love what you wrote in the column about sort of shedding that extra skin.
Everything I'd packed was intended to be lightweight. When we arrived and got our first look into the canyon, I immediately dumped my sleeping bag, half my food, and all the clothing I wasn't actually wearing. I also dug the lint out of my navel and cut off the ends of my bootlaces. Every ounce was going to count on this trip. What I did haul was plenty of water, energy supplements, and electrolyte powder. I also packed Band-Aid sunblock, sleeping pad, hiking staffs, and my army dog tags. If the worst happened, I didn't want anyone mixing up my remains with Buck's.
So you did have true fear staring into the abyss here.
Yeah, it's one thing to hike it in theory and do most of your hiking on the hills around Salt Lake, and another thing to look, you know, a mile down.
Mm-hmm. So you start on this hike. It's very, very hot.
Very hot.
At the Grand Canyon.
And you would think that the deeper you'd go, the cooler it would get. It's actually the reverse. The deeper you go, the hotter it gets. This is, was also included in the story about it. You have to stay hydrated while hiking the canyon. If not, you could suffer from what Buck kept calling heat frustration, the effects of which include hallucinating, getting lost, and in extreme cases, decomposition. The condors really liked that part. Once we were properly rehydrated, the trail continued on to the Devil's Corkscrew, a charming set of knee-splintering switchbacks down an airless microwave canyon to the Colorado River. We stopped at Pike Creek Rest House and pulled off our boots. There is no way to describe the sensation of cool water on hot, sore feet other than to say it violates any vow of celibacy.
That's so great.
And it was true, too. I mean, you stuck... By then, we had blisters and stuff, stuck our feet in Pipe Creek Springs there. And, you never wanted to leave.
Looking back, would you do it again?
Yeah, I probably would, because it was a great adventure. I had written about it so much in the Tribune. By the time we started going down the canyon, and we were bumping into rangers who had read about it and were watching for us coming down.
I don't know if that's better or worse.
It was actually good because they knew they were dealing with an idiot by then, you know, so they kept a good eye on us. They were great.
Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can read his columns at sltrib.com. You can also hear him unplugged each week here on Behind the Headlines. A quick reminder, join us for a town hall meeting, Cleaning Up Utah's Dirty Air. That is happening on Wednesday, January 29th at 7 here at the City Library. You can hear it live here on KCPW and look for a lot more information in the Salt Lake Tribune, sltrib.com, and check out our event page on Facebook. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support by Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening.